My name is Matthew Wayne Selznick, and this is Sonatotum, where I provide personal opinions, advice, reflection, and recommendations to help you and me stay human while building a successful, healthy, creative writing life. Sonatotum is the podcast companion to Scribtotum, my blog, at mattselznick.com. And now, the show. Here we are, gang. It's episode 10 of Sonatotum. And episode 10 is also our very first interview episode. And by our, I mean mine. I mean yours and mine, because you're listening and I'm speaking. And together we make the show. And this episode, we are joined by an independent creator, Emma Wallace. Emma is a pianist, singer, songwriter, composer, teacher. She has about a dozen albums, singles, and EPs out there. Anywhere you find digital music, you'll find her stuff. Spotify, Amazon, iTunes, Pandora, wherever. You may have even heard her music in some TV shows, folks. Yeah, I know, right? You can find Emma Wallace at imemma.com. Her latest record, Immortal, comes out, or has come out, depending on when you listen to this, August 31st, 2018. If you are a patron of Emma Wallace, you'll get to listen to it even earlier. Emma's got some great stuff to say about being an independent musician, supporting a family with your art, and all the struggles that come along with that. And we had a great conversation. I had a lot of fun, and I think you will enjoy it. I did. I think you'll learn something from it. I did. So let's get to it. On the other end of the interview, I'll have a few things to say, so stick around. Here's my conversation with Emma Wallace. So, okay, well, first of all, tell the world, what do you create?
I create music. I consider myself a songwriter, even though I also do it all. Like, I write the songs, I record them, I produce them, mix them, arrange them, not in that order, obviously. but I feel that's all part of the whole process of songwriting, of creating a full experience. And I want each song to be extremely conversational, like I'm there with you telling you exactly how I feel. And I want the songs to, the songs I create, I try to have be the type of song where you feel transported. Like you feel like, I don't know, like you've walked through the wardrobe into Narnia. And that would be the ideal, is you listen to my music and you feel like, oh, I just got to Narnia. So that's sort of what I create and how I think when I create a song, like how can I create this kind of world for my listener to go in and have this honest experience with me?
I know, like, I haven't heard your most recent stuff, but I know a lot of your stuff, the vocal especially, is very dry. It's very upfront. It's, you know, if you're listening on headphones, you are in our heads, which creates that, you know, that intimacy that you're looking for. But why specifically, why is that so important to you?
I don't know. I mean, I'm a big fan of Sting, which I'm sure will come up unless we only talk for 3 seconds. and I remember hearing him in an interview, and he had said how he considers himself a storyteller. And I was like, oh, that's so, you know, romantic and cool, because Sting could say anything. I think it's romantic and cool. But after kind of analyzing my own music and how I tend to write, I feel like I'm not a storyteller. I feel like I'm a conversationalist. And I think that even now, more than when I started creating songs, is there's this need for connection, you know, that we all have this need for connection. You know, we go on Instagram and check things and like things and comment and hope somebody notices our comment and then hope somebody likes our comment and all this. And it's this crazy thing. And yet then we go out and we like waiting in line at Chipotle and we're all looking at our phones, you know, nobody's making eye contact. And it kind of feels like what we really need. I mean, you look at all the mental health issues that have shown up more and more publicized now. And it's just, it feels like we all just want someone to like talk to us and we all just want someone to listen to us. And so when I create my music, I want the person who's listening to feel like I'm their best friend. I'm their lover. I'm right there with them. And I'm not there telling them a story. I'm not there to do something dramatic and interesting. And so sometimes I'll even specifically with a song, I'll write it so it's slightly too low for my voice because then it sounds like very confessional. Like, okay, I'm talking to you and I'm talking to you and I'm saying something that's so open that my voice gets a little bit scratchy. And I'll purposely write the song that way because I feel like otherwise it sounds too pretty. You know, I want it to have that honesty to it because I feel like that's how people feel that connection. And that's the most important thing that I want people to get from my music is to feel, it sounds really cheesy, but to feel loved, like to feel like I'm loved, I'm listened to, I've been connected with, you know.
What is it about your past or your personality or, you know, if you're looking to create that for other people, there must be a yearning in it that you have. What's behind that?
I've always wanted to connect with people, like even from being a kid and, you know, as a little kid, I was totally like, I was very misbehaved, but I was also like a people pleaser. Like I was, even in high school and stuff, like I was like, you know, Anne Hathaway, like I tried so hard. I wanted everybody to like me type thing. and I always felt like so much of being, what's the word? Properly socialized is learning how to be cool. Like, right. You know, it's learning how to, okay, let's not act too excited. Let's not act like we really care about somebody else. And I really feel like if you were stranded alone with anybody for an extended length of time, you would fall in love with them because I mean, we all have so many amazing stories and thoughts and interesting things that we like. And it's just, I mean, blows me away when I think like I'll talk to somebody and I'll just be talking to somebody about something totally random and they'll be like, oh yeah, well, when I took unicycling lessons, I'm like, how amazing is that? I mean, people are so amazing. And so I feel like what happens is we go through, at least for me, I don't know how everybody else goes through life because I'm only in my head, but in my head, I always feel like how amazing, it sounds really whatever, but I can see how amazing I am. And not to say that in like, I'm more amazing than anybody else, but how amazing humans are, like all these things we've gone right through, all these stories we've had. I mean, I worked so many jobs that when I applied to work at Disney at one point in my early 20s, they had 10 spots or 20 spots for jobs. And I had worked, I couldn't fit them all in there. I had worked so many jobs by the time I was like 22. And I'm like, that's awesome. I'm like the jack of all trades. It's amazing. I can't even get a job at Disney. I actually did get a job at Disney, but, so I feel like I know I'm not the only one because anytime I talk to anybody for a length of time, I'm blown away by how wonderful they are. And I think we just don't tell that to other people and we just don't hear it, you know? And you see that with, it is like a side thing with celebrities when they'll pass away and then people will post up, oh, this person meant so much to me. They were so, this totally impacted my life. And other celebrities will say that. And then just like people. And I mean, it takes that kind of losing the person for us to feel like, wow, this person really made a difference to me. And I don't want anyone to feel like they're not amazing and they're not wonderful. My music isn't like, you know, like motivational music or anything. It's just, I feel like that's that pursuit of happiness that we have. That's what makes us happy is the feeling of being loved and loving, you know, like that song, the Nature Boy song. And so I feel like that that's to me, I mean, there are other people who write this amazing stuff where it makes you feel like, you know, like it's an interesting story and it makes you question how you see the world, and people who make, you know, all these different things that they work at getting you to feel when they listen to your music, but when you listen to their music. But for me, I always just, I want to have that sense of getting to hear, to know other people, to make that connection. I even did that when I would play live, where I'd like try to look, like connect with every person in the audience, if I'm not looking at them, but to feel that, like, okay, I'm singing this for you. This is for you, you know, random person three rows back, because nobody's a random person, you know? And so that's how I feel about that.
When you were growing up, was that kind of connection, that sort of deep empathy for other people, was that something that was cultivated and encouraged, or maybe even just the opposite? And that's, you know, why it became such a strong mission for you.
Well, it's interesting because I grew up and I had a weird upbringing. I mean, I think probably everybody does, right? When you talk to people, they're like, well, my child was kind of weird. And you're like, oh yeah, I know. Mine was, everybody's was, I think.
Child. What's the line about happy families?
Yeah. Exactly. So, I was homeschooled. So that was the whole lack of socialization. I was homeschooled up till eighth grade. And we did have, like, my parents were very, very, very heavily involved in church. Like my dad was like really, really, really crazy about church. So like even now I could probably quote you chapters of the Bible, because we had to memorize chapters of the Bible as kids. And a lot of what I grew up with was believing that other people are, one thing is other people are evil, right? We're all evil. We're not all awesome and amazing, as I just said. We're all evil, horrible, filthy people. And then God saves us, and then we're still evil and filthy until we die, right? And then the other thing is that to want people to like you, or to even to like the idea of connecting with other people is somewhat questionable. I mean, like, I would like to talk to people, and it was, oh, you talk too much, you know, and or you're self-centered. I got told so much when I was a kid, you're self-centered. And honestly, every kid is self-centered, because that's the only way we can relate to the world is through ourselves.
Course.
And so we are just by default the center of our own universe. And so I was told that so much. And so what happened was, is it kind of made me feel like, okay, so how can I not be self-centered? Like what does it mean to not be self-centered? Not because I was trying to be obedient necessarily, but because I was curious, like, what does that even mean to not be self-centered? And so I started to listen, so what's your story? I'd ask people, what's your story? And that started like right on the edge of high school. And by doing all that, I realized like how non-filthy and evil people are, how they are amazing, and how everybody just wants, I mean, you look at the people who are doing all this really heinous stuff in the government, and you go like, they really, I mean, they want someone to love them. They're going about it in the wrongest way possible, but that's what they want. You know, they just feel scared, and they feel unloved, and they feel like they don't have enough money, because if anything happens to them, nobody will help them out. You know, I mean, like, you don't see Buddhist monks worrying about money, and not because they're like, I mean, they're awesome, but also because they know if anything happens, they'll be taken care of. There's a sense of peace and belief that the universe will take care of them, and, you know, other people will. And these other greedy people in the government are not doing that, because they're like, if I do something wrong and I lose my money, I'm out there, I'm on the street, you know? And it all comes down to feeling like, I think partly feeling like what I was taught growing up, that everyone else is evil and horrible, and so you better watch your back. And also that you are evil and horrible, and so no one's going to want to help you. And so if we all just were like, wait a minute, everybody has something that's amazing to connect with, and then I think that would really shift the way we interact with other people.
So you said that you were homeschooled until eighth grade or through eighth grade?
Until eighth grade. Yeah. So I went to eighth grade.
Right. Okay. So yeah, that transition must have been like, whoa, look at all, first of all, humans are totally different than what I thought they were. But more interesting to me, and you know, my storyteller brain goes, okay, well, there's a big conflict right there, because suddenly you had this evidence of a world that was different from the world that you had been, you know, taught was how it was, you know. Did that lead to some, I mean, you know, other than the obvious usual parent-child conflict that happens when you hit your teenage years, that must have exacerbated some things, huh?
Well, I mean, the thing is that we, like I said, we were really involved in the church. So I had a pretty close group of, I mean, I had friends that I saw a lot. So, so I did have, you know, personal connections that were close.
Well, that's true. Yeah. I didn't mean that you were like, you know, the girl in the bubble or something like that. But I mean, high school and junior high would have exposed you to people who were not in that church community.
Well, the biggest realization for me actually had to do with me. Because I was self-centered, like I told you. So what I thought, I remember going to school the first day and thinking, this is going to be so great. Everybody's going to be my friend, you know. And you know what's funny is not, that wasn't actually what happened.
Wait,
not everybody
what?
Was So, yeah. So, I had people who were mean to me and people who, my dad taught at the school I went to, and he taught drama. And so all these girls had crushes on him. So they would like be friends with me because then they would like be able to see my dad and everything. So it was very, that was kind of like eye opening for me. But I think what happened was I just readjusted because I made connections with other people that were great. And I realized it was the same, you know, I was back to the same kind of thing where I realized that they were doing this because this is how they knew how to interact with the world. I mean, the nice thing about going in at eighth grade is that everybody's really a mess at eighth grade. I mean, there's nobody who's really got things together. Yeah. And they're like, oh yeah, I totally have this figured out. So, I mean, like if I'd gone at like fourth grade, I mean, fourth graders are really like have their heads on straight, you know, but eighth graders, they've lost it. So, I came in at a good time where I could be like, oh, I'm just like everybody else. We're all just, you know, such a mess. Yeah.
So when did music start to come in for you?
Well, I had been a singer. I mean, well, I had sung in front of our church, of course. And when I was like three, so it was kind of like, oh, Emma's a singer. And there was like this whole, like, I was the musical one type thing. And then we did piano lessons and my brother was far more adept at piano than I was. In fact, for the first 2 years of piano lessons, I never learned how to read notes because I would just let him go first and then I would memorize what he played by ear and then I would go up there and play it until one time he was sick, which was really rude of him. So I had to go first and she's like, what's this? And I'm like, I couldn't fake it because I had no idea. I'm like, oh no. So, but because my piano teacher had told my mom, oh, Emma's a real sweet girl, but she's just not talented at music. And I had this whole rebellious thing where I was like, what? So then I went home and was extremely competitive and practiced and practiced and practiced and did. And that became like my thing was music. So I did it in eighth grade all the way through high school. And then at the end of high school, I applied for University of North Florida jazz program. And I told my chorus teacher that I had auditioned singing and piano. And he said, you sang? He's like, Emma, stay behind the piano. He said it just like that. And I felt like I had been punched in the stomach. And dang. I thought, I'm like, well, here's the thing. I'm going to get into University of North Florida and I'm going to show him. And I didn't get in. So I was like, oh, maybe I should have stayed behind the piano. So I kind of stopped singing and I decided, okay, I'm going to go to school for humanities and philosophy and did that for a year. And then I said, I'm going to be an actress. So I went to Seattle and did like theater stuff. And as like, I was on a date with them guy and he was like, and I did like a Billie Holiday impression. And he was like, oh, that was amazing. And I'm like, you're joking, right? And he's like, no. And so then I'm like, well, here's my real voice. And so I say, and he was like, wow, you've got such, and I couldn't, I know it sounds ridiculous, but that one comment totally shifted my whole self-perception where I was all this time, I had thought, oh, people are just were just being nice all those years when they said I could sing. It was just, they were just being nice, you know. And then when, so that totally changed it. So then I was like, okay, I'm going to do music. And
well, you had had. I mean, up until then, you had had two people who were very important in your life give you such negative feedback about that skill set. So
right.
hearing it from someone who, you know, was, sure, you're on a date and whatnot, but he's a relative stranger, you know.
Right.
So it's almost like, wait a minute, this is a very almost objective point of view coming in and giving me this opposite information. And, you know, it couldn't have hurt that, you know, you were on the other side of the country, you know, probably living your life maybe for the first time and feeling your oats. And, you know, it's like, hey, maybe there's something to this. Yeah. No,
yeah.
I mean, sometimes that's what it takes, I think, is to have your parents and people who are close to you. They're either going to put every single thing you do up on the refrigerator or not.
Right.
You know,
exactly.
But you get used to whatever that standard becomes as you're growing up, you know. And yeah, if this was the story, that would be the part of the montage, you know, in the movie where there would definitely be a musical moment there where you would break into song about how, you know, you now have your life and your confidence ahead of you and all that.
Exactly. Well, actually, I took from a voice teacher up in Seattle because of that. And right. I could sing, I could do what. So I took from a voice teacher and he taught me. I ended up quitting because he kept wanting me to do Broadway. And he specifically thought I should do ingenue roles. That was what he kept doing. So I kept trying to sing like lower stuff. Like, I'm like, I want to sing My Heart Belongs to Daddy. And he's like, no. That's not where you need to sing. You need to, and he kept pushing me to like Christine and stuff like that from Phantom of the Opera. And but he, at one point after a lesson, he sat me down and he's like, Emma, I want to know, do you have the chutzpah to go the whole way? Do you think you would go to Broadway? Because I think you could make it. And I was like, and so that was the second one. So that both of those things happened in Seattle. Was that thing. I can remember what the guy was wearing. I can remember like his couch, you know, because I'm like, oh my gosh, he just asked me if I had the chutzpah to move to New York City.
Wow.
So I didn't move to New York City, but I did go on to like feel like, okay, at the very least, two people like my singing. And so if two people like my singing, then probably a couple more people like it. So that's something that I can work with since I love doing it so much.
Is it around then that you started performing, you know, publicly or professionally? I mean, other than, you know, I mean, of course the church stuff and the school stuff, but like actually going out into clubs and doing gigs and things like that. When did that begin to happen?
Well, I left Seattle because the guy who said my music was so wonderful, we broke up and I was very devastated by it. So I moved back home and I was talking with my mom one night and about how, you know, probably the millionth time of like, what did I do wrong? And why do you know? And I'm like,
I just, do.
Yes. Like one does exactly. Except for you guy. No, I'm just I'll still link to you. But no.
Trust me. Oh boy. No. Yeah. The self-analysis and the beating oneself up is universal.
But, and so she said, I just wish I were Sting. If I were like living like Sting, like creating music and doing all this, then I think I would be happy and it wouldn't even bother me, you know, because I'd be so happy with who I was and everything. And my mom was probably really impatient at this point because we had this conversation so many times. And she's like, well, Sting writes his own music, so you're never going to be Sting unless you write your own music. And I was like, oh, okay, well, that was kind of harsh. But so I went home and I wrote a song that night, April 15th, 2002. I wrote a song every, you know, I just kept writing songs, so many songs, and 90% of them were just horrible. And but I was like, I'm going to be Sting. So I'm going to write all this stuff. And I had a professor because I had gone back to school for humanities. And I played one of my, but the professor was a musician as well. He had his friend down who was a professional musician who like played around the area. And I had told him I did music. He's like, oh, I said I write songs. He's like, oh, let me hear your songs. And I had never at that point played them for anybody other than my little sister. And so I was like, okay. So I played, I think it was Da Vinci Part 2. And he laughed at like one of the jokes in the song. And I remembered feeling like, Wow, he laughed. I'm like, can I sing that again? Let me sing that again for you right now. I'll just sing the whole thing over. And so that totally, then it was like, you know, the next step up. This wasn't even somebody I was paying or somebody I was dating. It was just some random guy who laughed at my song, who was a musician. So then that's when I kind of gathered my stuff together and started performing and started, you know, I recorded an EP, put that out there. And that was what started that whole thing churning, you know, moving along.
So you and I met when we were both working at the Pasadena Borders Books and Music.
May it rest in peace. Yes.
Yes, indeed. And that had to have been, oh man, I don't know, 2004, 2003, something like that.
Yeah. 2004. Yeah.
So at what point, I mean, what was coming to Southern California, the prototypical, I'm going to go to LA with my music and that's where it's happening. Or did you just kind of end up out here?
Well, it actually was very intentional because my my mentor, he's actually my uncle. You can edit that out. my uncle works in the music business.
I'm encouraged to hear that you had a family member who was encouraging you with your music.
Well, he was he did mixing. He had a mixing studio and stuff, and he still does. Now he works in TV and mixes stuff in Vegas and mixes sound in Vegas. He's great. But I had moved out to make my next album with him. So that was why I had moved to LA. But at the time I moved, it just didn't quite gel. You know, he was going through some stuff and we were having, you know, financial issues, as one does in Pasadena, and working at bookstores. So both my partners and my family were back in Florida, and so it didn't really end up like I was gigging out, and I had I had extremely unrealistic ideas of what was going to happen. I'm going to be in LA and I'm going to be playing. And George Clooney, because like George Clooney was like the actor, right? 2004, or whoever would have been, is going to walk in and he's going to be blown away and he's going to have me play at his next party. And now I'm going to be famous, you know? And so every single gig you go to and George Clooney's not there, it starts to get, you know, wear on your soul.
Right.
Where is George Clooney?
Not only that, but so many of those gigs you realize, oh, I'm really just a human jukebox while these people are talking and trying to get laid. And
exactly.
Is anybody actually listening? Yeah.
I know. And they get kind of like irritated where they're like, you walk up there and like, oh my God, someone's going to play. We're in the middle of a conversation. And so like, and the barista is like steaming the latte and you're like, oh, okay. And you're like, this is like the intimate part of the song where it's like so important. And it's like, or making the frappuccino or whatever.
All through the 90s, I played in pretty much every coffee house in Orange County from like San Clemente all the way up to Long Beach. So like 50 miles of coffee houses in the 90s, I played them all. And yes, that's so it. Number one, you know, I wasn't the kind of artist who played, and remember it was the 90s, I wasn't the kind of artist who played Tracy Chapman covers. And, you know, and so you're up there, you're doing your originals or you're doing covers that no one has ever heard of or covers that their parents loved, but they don't know. Talk about earning your stripes, right? It's fun to hear that you went through that whole very similar experience and the espresso machine backup is. Yeah, that's a given. That's a rite of passage. That should be on everybody's first album. Just 20 seconds of that, just in the middle of something.
Right, you like right after the drop. You got the build, and the music drops off, and then you hear that.
Yeah, right before Pitbull says "Dolly Dolly."
Exactly.
Oh man. Okay, so LA wasn't turning out to be quite what you wanted it to be. So back home you went, and things seem to have that seems to have been the right decision.
Yeah, well, what actually I think made the difference, and I think it could have happened anywhere, because what I ended up doing, I mean, was I started making my own music. That's really what was the turning point for me, was I started recording my own music, because I love performing. I absolutely love performing. But unless you're touring, I mean, there are only so many, even if you have like crazy diehard fans, if you're trying to gig out once a week or even once a month, there's only so many times, you know, your crazy diehard fans are going to show up. And, right. And I would start to realize that when I'm like, you know, my mom would be like, oh yeah, I can be there. I should be there. I mean, I have to work early the next morning. I'm like, oh man, you know, it's bad when your mom's like, oh wow, I got to work early in the morning. I'm like, no, this could be my big break though, mom. You know? So I get
to meet George Clooney.
Exactly. He's supposed to show up at some point, even in Orlando, you know, the dream never stops. What happened was, and this is kind of like the foundation on which making a sustainable living as a musician is based, is having no overhead. It's so unromantic, but it's so true. Yeah. Because the first record I did, the EP I did with my uncle. And so I flew out to LA. So the overhead was basically, you know, I paid for the musicians that played on it. So I paid a little bit. The studio that we recorded in was actually James Raymond, who is David Crosby's son, was the studio in which I recorded. So that was cool. There's my name drop of the night.
Nice. Very nice.
I recorded, James Raymond actually is an amazing composer and songwriter himself. But then I paid for photo shoot and I paid for, you know, the whole thing. And that was my EP. That was just kind of, we burned the CDs on our own, you know, because people listen to CDs. We would burn the CDs on our computer, our laptop.
Right, right.
And then send a few
to CD Baby.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yep. And the second album was, okay, this is going to be it. This is, I'm going to be famous. You know, it's 2007. I had come back. And then I ended up flying. This was the album I had initially moved out to LA to make. But I ended up moving back home, and then I flew out to LA, and it still didn't quite work out. So I ended up kind of doing like recording with some guy here and using some of the recordings that we did in LA for my next album. That was A Reason to Stay Up All Night. And that one, I paid the producer, I paid to get it mastered, I paid to get 1,000 copies of the CD, which is really a bad choice, and I paid to get and I paid to get posters. I like, when we moved to the apartment
posters.
We're in, yeah, wow. Yeah, they're like, it's only gonna be an extra $100. And you get all, and I'm like, get some steel. This isn't, you know, because I paid for publicity. I paid for a website. I paid for everything, right? I shelled up. Because at that point, I had actually gotten a job working, doing event coordinating for the Orange County Library System. So I was making a salary position. So I was making pretty good money. So I threw all this money at this record. And it came out, and it did okay. It actually, you know, did okay. But it didn't come close to making back anything that I had. And what happened was, is I got where I'm like, I have more songs I want to record. I don't have that money to, because at that point I had been like, I'm going to be famous. So I quit my job at the library, and I was doing music, and I was actually supporting myself on, you know, doing composing for people and stuff. But I was supporting myself on my retirement account from the library that I pulled out. Exactly. So I had that, and, you know, a few credit cards and that sort of thing. So what happened was, is my desire to make more music was just, I had to figure out a way to do it, and I didn't have the money to pay anybody. So my partner's like, you have to figure out how to do it yourself. And I'm like, that's not the kind of person that I'm not good at that. I'm a songwriter. I'm a performer. I'm not technical. I'm not, you know, and this whole entire thing. And eventually what I did is I started a blog where every week I would release a cover, which now I think was illegal because I wasn't paying anybody anything, but I would release a cover every week. And then every once in a while I'd throw an original in there. And by recording every single week, it forced me to learn how mm-hmm. to do stuff. Mm-hmm. And I've been a big proponent of you just put out crap until you learn how to make good stuff. And then you put out slightly better crap. And then you get something. Sure. Yeah. So now I can look back at some of my songs I put out. And I'm like, I remember when I sat down with my uncle to show him like one of the songs I had mixed. And I'm like, I don't even remember what it was. I think it was Reverb or something. And I was like wet and dry. So this is like right and left. And he's like, actually it has nothing to do with right and left. And I'm like, oh, wow. So, okay. So these last two records were totally wrong. So, I mean like stuff like that, that was so, so wrong. But because I knew how I wanted it to sound, I would just kind of mess with it enough that it was
right.
Okay.
Right.
And I still had to pay someone. I still had to pay someone to master it, but I didn't get it pressed or anything. And I would take all the songs, I would put them all up to sell, and I'd submit them to licensing libraries. And then immediately I'd start working on the next record, and I would do everything here. And I kept moving back where I'm okay, not paying anyone to do the music, like to do the beats. I'm going to figure out how to do that myself. I'm not going to pay anyone, you know, I'm going to do my own website. I'm going to keep scaling back the outsourcing of who I'm paying. And what it did is it allows me to get better at writing music and get better at singing, get better at playing, and still be able to make money from my music along the way. And not have to, okay, I'm going to hold up and every single record doesn't become this is going to make it or break it. You know, if it doesn't sell well, if people don't like it, then I've got nothing, you know? And I was really lucky because that first A Reason to Stay Up All Night did well enough that I didn't just throw in the towel. Because I've had other records since then that haven't done as well as that one. Some that have done better. And if I had one of those less performing records be that one, I might've been discouraging enough because I put so much money into it. But this one, but now I put it out and I'm like, you know, if you like it, that's awesome. If you don't like it, I've got another one coming at you in just a couple months. So stay tuned. I think that's the big thing that was the turning point, was learning how to do stuff myself. And every time I get up and I'd be like, I don't know how to do this. Like when I started doing electronic music, my last record was more electronic than this one that I'm releasing one on August 31st, an EP. And that's going to have like a lot more electronic elements to it because I just love the way it sounds. And to me, it's an extension of storytelling to be able to add all this other production to it. I mean, it's an extension to songwriting. Yeah. So, but it was the same kind of thing where I'm like, I just wish I could collaborate with somebody who would do all this for me. And then I'm like, okay, well now you got to pay somebody. Now you got to figure out, I'm just gonna figure out how to do it myself. Because eventually, you know, at some point they didn't know how to do it. And you look at the like producers who are like really famous and really good. And they're like 12. And so I'm like, if they can figure it out in like 2 years, then I can figure it out.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, at that point, you have to, you know, you're basically, you can either trade money for time or but if you don't have the money, then you're trading time for experience.
Yeah.
And at a certain point, you know, that pays off with your own art, or it pays off because you now have a skill that you can sell to someone else to support your
art. Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Yeah, very true.
That was my path. Completely with independent publishing is same thing. It's like, well, I don't know how to format a paperback book, so I guess I'll figure that out. I don't know how to create an ebook, so I figure that out. Create a website, figure that out, and you know, create a podcast. Hell, even that. It's the Mickey Rooney, Judy Garland. Hey kids, let's put on a show.
Right? Yeah, exactly.
We have an empty garage and a few bales of hay, and somebody has a sewing machine, and I've got a bullhorn, so let's go.
Right.
You know?
And I feel like it's exciting. I mean, for me, it's one of those things where if George Clooney walks in my house now, because I'm not playing out, so that would get really awkward at this point. But but if
you're like, George, we are recording right now. Can you just wait? But, you had your chance, buddy.
I know, man. All those but if I were to get to mainstream at this point, you know, I feel so much better prepared for it. I mean, if I had made it when I wanted to make it, which was 3 seconds after I wrote my first song, right? I'm a genius. I should be a scientist. If I had made it then, or if I'd even made it in LA, you know, when I had written at that point, whatever, 15 sing of like songs that were good enough to play out, or 20. And all I could do was play piano and sing and write songs. Yeah. Not that that's not, you know, I mean, you know, that's what Frank Sinatra could just sing, and he was great. But if I had gotten it then I would have been locked into whatever the producer thought was the right choice for me and whatever, you know, and now I feel like I have so much more understanding about writing music, period, that I'm not going to have, like, I mean, if I talk to somebody and they say, oh, you need to fix this on the production, I'll be like, no, that's impossible. You know what I mean? Like now I feel, yeah, exactly. So I love that I'm so much more prepared to be, to not just be an ingenue, you know, not just be like you're a star and let's just smile at the camera. You know, now I can be like, actually I want to do this, this is really important to me. I'm not going to do this. And I wasn't like that 15 years ago or 10 years ago, whenever it was. So I'm really happy now that I've learned how to do it. So every single step along the way, when I'm like, maybe I'll get there, you know? And I have kind of gotten to many theirs, you know, not exactly the there that I keep shooting for, but of course that, you know, that benchmark keeps kind of shifting as you get to different places. You should benchmark. You say, okay, now I want to get here, you know? But when I think of like the whole being discovered thing, I just feel like I'm in a much better place to have a much more enjoyable and expressive career as a musician at this point than I was 10 years ago.
You talked about benchmarks and how they keep moving, and you still talk in terms of being discovered. If you had your druthers, what is that next step? And what does even being discovered mean at this point?
Yeah, I know. I've kind of struggled with that for sure, because there's a part of me that's like, you know, you're there, you're doing it, you're supporting a family of four. As a musician, I do teach and do coaching and stuff too. And have multiple streams of income. I do licensing. I've done some custom songs for people. I have my streaming does well. Royalties from ASCAP do well and that sort of thing. So I make like Spotify, which is, you know, supposed to be the bane of musicians' existence. I make a pretty good amount of money from Spotify. So it's just, I guess I feel like, maybe it's just, it's like a goal that I set at, you know, whatever, 18 that I keep chasing after. And maybe at some point I'll get over that. But I feel like it would be nice to be, I don't know, I don't have like a lot of press. I mean, I don't have, you know, to be where I feel like, it sounds really, I want to be famous. No, but kind of like at the level where like I can do tours and know that I'll get a full house, mm-hmm. and where I can put out an album and know that it's gonna, you know, hit the charts to a certain degree. And right now I feel like I have a nice, you know, that whole 10,000 fans thing. I have a good core group of fans that support me and listen to me. But I don't make enough from sales and streaming to have that be a consistent source where I don't also have to teach, you know,
And I was going to say, maybe just dropping the teaching would be the goal. You know,
right, exactly, yeah. Exactly. And I mean, it's not that I even don't enjoy teaching. It's just that the teaching is okay. That's the way to have a dependable income, because otherwise, you know how it is. Like I got the song on this thing, so now my sales have skyrocketed for this one song. Well, it doesn't continue to skyrocket.
Three weeks later, yeah, exactly. You're back to ramen.
You're like, okay, well, that was nice. And and like I would get like a big royalty check, and I'll be like, I should quit my job. And I'm like, well, let's just wait and see what next month is like. I mean, and I've gone through and quit all of. I used to work for a music studio, teaching there, and I quit that. And now I get to call my own shots. I make my own hours. I have a waiting list of students so I'm an entrepreneur still and everything, and doing everything mm-hmm. the way I want. But I just feel like it's not at, there's still a bit of like a. I'm at the cusp. I'm definitely closer to that. Okay, this is my career. It sustains me really, really easily, really comfortably. And a year ago, it was much shakier. And 3 years ago, it was much, much, much shakier, because I've had where I've quit to do music. Like I quit to do my quit that library gig back job back in 2008. Yeah, I quit in 2008. And man, I've had some really low financial times since then. And now it's kind of amazing to me to be able to say something like, okay, I'm going to pay, whatever, $20 a month for my Squarespace subscription, right. And to be able to not be like, well, I really hope I can pay it next month, that's a mm-hmm. big jump mm-hmm. forward from, several years ago. So I know I'm definitely like working on that route, but there's still I think the thing is that even if I got to the point where, okay, I'm not teaching anymore, I'm making whatever, six figures on my music or whatever. I don't even care about that kind of thing. But I think I would still have another goal, because for me, I feel like there's that, like, I like the idea of moving towards something. So I'd probably be like, okay, now I want this. And now, not that I would never be satisfied, because I'm happy with where I'm at, but I just, always want to be moving forward type thing.
I can really relate to the idea that, like getting to the point where you can maybe stop or cut way back on, or be very selective about your teaching, because even though, and it's the same way with me with, I build websites and do editing and whatnot for people. And I enjoy helping other people with their creative work. And it's fulfilling to see that, them, bring those things into the world. But it does take energy away from the stuff that you want to do,
Right.
And time is limited, whether it's, just the time in the day, and you've got two kids, right?
Right.
And so your time is even more constrained. I don't think it's self-centered to be able to dedicate all of your time to creating your stuff. In fact, I'd almost go as far as to say it's kind of our responsibility, as creators, mm-hmm.
Right.
Because nobody else can do what you do the way you do it.
Right.
And you never know what impact what you do, the way you do it, is going to have on somebody else. So, part of the focus of the show is kind of overcoming really tough stuff to be able to continue to create, or to get to the point where you can comfortably create. Is there a point along this 10, 15 year path where you can really point to and go, man, that was the tough one.
Yeah. I remember the day, because it was Halloween and I had taken my son trick or treating, and I had a knock at the door at 9 o'clock, and I went to go open the door, because I thought, right, it's Halloween, it's a trick or treater. Yeah. And it was a debt collector. And I was like, oh my, I had never had anything like that. And what happened was, I remember I signed the thing, that I got the papers, and everything. It was for like a credit card. I didn't even have that much on it. It's a credit card that I had had to use several years earlier, and I had forgotten. You know, I called them up and said, I can't make any payments. And they're like, okay, well, call when you can. And I was like, okay. And I couldn't, so I hadn't, you know.
Right, blood from a stone. Sure,
yeah, I'm
sure.
Like, yeah, okay, sure, you can, you know, exactly. I'll write you a song.
This song goes out to MasterCard.
Exactly. It was a MasterCard too. Very good. But I remembered I was calling my mom and I'm crying. I'm like, what is the point of all this? Like, why am I doing this? I've got a kid. I need to get my act together. This is ridiculous. Mm. At this point, I should have outgrown this. That's what I kept thinking. You know, because
How old were you?
I was in my early 30s. I don't remember. 32.
Okay.
Yeah. So I was in my early 30s, and because I had my son was born when I was 29. Yeah. I was 32. I guess that's the thing I kept thinking. I remember when I had done one gig and a professor of mine had come out from UCF. One of my favorite professors, he taught Jewish history. And I walked him out to his car after the gig and he said, Emma, come on, you're better than this. You should be a professor. Why are you out here trying to sing for audiences? You can do better than this. And I was like, okay. And so that's like, well, those are those kinds of sayings that play through your head when your debt collector comes to the door on Halloween night, you know? Yeah. And you enter the door dressed like a cave person. You think that's who's coming to the door. You know, my son was a dinosaur, even though I know it was historically inaccurate. I was a dinosaur. So it did something.
Flintstone's accurate.
Exactly. That's right. See? So, cartoon hacker. My mom was like talking to me and I had this whole thing of like I had an epiphany at that moment where I'm like this. And so she was saying something. I'm like, this is what I want you to say. I want you to say you're doing the right thing. This is what you're meant to do. And you keep doing what you're doing. It's going to work out. It's going to be okay.
And you wanted her to just be your mom.
Yeah, exactly. And I just wanted to feel like I was doing the right thing. Because there's so much where, you know, you get that sense of like, oh, you had a garage, you know, you were part of a garage band when you were a teenager, or you sang when you were in your 20s. And like, there's like a feeling of like you outgrow this thing. But the thing is that a passion for music and for creating, acting, whatever it is that you have a passion for, it's artistic creation and expression. You don't outgrow that. I mean,
you can't not do it. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And that's something too. I got to talk to my partner and I asked him and I'm like, and he's like, well, if you don't do this, what would you do? Is there anything else that you would even want to do? And I'm like, there's nothing else I want to do. And he's like, well, then you don't have a choice. This is what you have to do. That was a really rough month. We were late on the rent and it was this whole thing. And what ended up helping me is I had two people I was teaching lessons to at the time, two families. And I went to one of the moms and I'm like, I need help. Can you get me some other students, please? And so she's like, 'cause I'm like, you know, a lot of people, I didn't ask, you know, so I didn't ask her for money, but I asked her for help. And so she posted up on her neighborhood website, advertisement for me on the thing. And I actually still get calls from that she posted up. And that one act of, you know, of kindness where she posted that up and I got three or four people call me and then those people call in. And now I have, you know, I teach in these crazy, you know, several million dollar houses and stuff. But it all came from her posting that up and that was what changed. And then of course, as happens with, you know, music and stuff, I also got, I got a licensing deal for, you know, $400. And I got another licensing deal for $200. And so like little by little, I was able to regain momentum. And I started doing something, this is also going to sound really like cheesy, but I started doing like a gratitude thing where I'd focus on what I was grateful for and I'd do all, and it just started to help me shift my perspective. Because the thing is, and I know you'll understand this, creating music is like, it's like, you know, like when you fall in love and you are going to go meet the person or whatever, and you think to yourself, I don't know how I got so lucky. How did I get so lucky to have this person love me, right? And you just feel like that sense of like overwhelmment of gratitude for how great your life is just at that moment. That's what I feel like every time I think about the fact that I create music. And I think about that even with musicians that I don't care for their music. And when I think about them, I feel this kinship with them because yes. I'm like, you do this amazing thing. Yeah, whatever your songs are about, whatever. The point is that you take something that's completely intangible and somehow put it into something else that's intangible. And now you made somebody happy, or you made somebody cry, or you made people fall in love, or you made people dance, or it's so amazing. And music is crazy because it's completely unnecessary for our life. And yet it's the only reason like that we live, you know?
Is it though?
I mean,
for our life?
I mean, in terms of like, if you were to look at like, say, a doctor, but this is what I'm saying, is that it's the reason why we live. It's basically the whole, you know, the whole utopian dream that we all kind of have. Oh, in the future, things are going to be better. Oh, my life's going to get better and everything. That feeling is like, that's what music is now for. Like music is like a taste of the utopian future, but you live it now, you know, it's amazing. It's such an amazing thing to be somebody who creates that. And so I just feel so much gratitude and appreciation for the fact that that's what I do. That's my life. And even if part of it is doing stuff like teaching people, what I'm teaching people is to do that. I'm teaching kids to be able to sit down and create this amazing.
You're building legacy. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's like a superpower. So I think music is just the most amazing, amazing thing to be, to be a part of. When I listen to it, I feel grateful. And when I create it, I feel grateful. So just thinking that to go like, you can't outgrow it. I mean, you don't tell Superman, okay, you got to outgrow flying, you know, come on. It's an amazing thing that we can do.
You seemed a little uncomfortable or a little like the caveat of, oh, it sounds cheesy, but, and then you talked about the gratitude piece. And I don't think that's cheesy at all. I think, I mean, there's even from a scientific neurological point of view, there's all kinds of evidence that having that positive attitude, that positivity, and recognizing gratitude and focusing on things that are other than the negative, you know, it creates that dopamine, those endorphins that without the help of anything else.
Right, exactly.
So there's nothing cheesy about it at all, but how did you go from, oh crap, you know, the bill collector saw me in my caveman outfit to embracing things like gratitude and recognizing the mission of your life and its validity?
Well, I guess what happened was,
I mean, you had the support of your partner and, you know, which is hugely important to know that at least one person who's very important in your life is in your corner, but was there?
Well, I think what happened was I kind of got, I got desperate where I'm like, I need some sort of, I mean, I've always been like an optimistic, positive thinking person where I'd write out my, you know, I'll write out my goals and write out affirmations and stuff. And I'd go through different phases of like different types of self-help type things. You know, you worked in the bookstore, so you know the whole section.
Well, sure. And, vision board. And
yeah,
whatnot.
Exactly. I had vision board and everything. And I would get to this thing where I'd read something that'd be like, follow your dreams. You never know. You might, you know, shoot for the moon, you'll land among the stars. And besides the fact that that's impossible, inaccurate. I would get angry because I'd be like, follow my dreams. That's like all I've been doing since I graduated from college. And it's this feeling of like, I've done it and it's not working, you know? And I thought like, maybe the problem isn't that my life is so bad. Maybe the problem is just that I'm looking at it incorrectly. Because there are people who are incredibly unhappy with their lives and are super successful, you know, and have a lot of money and have the, you know, beautiful lover and whatever, right? And the gorgeous house. And so, you know, I mean, and now teaching, I see that a lot where I go to these houses and I'm like, not everybody, but it's a mix. You know, there's still a lot of happy people, a lot of unhappy people. And it doesn't really matter whether you drive a Porsche or a Toyota, you know?
Right,
and what I thought was, well, if I want to get famous, if I want to get successful and wealthy and whatever, you know, abundant, wherever I get to the point where I feel financially stable and everything's going the way that I want to, obviously it's not the circumstances that are making me happy or unhappy. You know, I think right around that time, somebody who was famous had committed suicide. I don't remember who it was. Mm. Might have been Robin Williams. It was something like that. And so I kind of, it was like a stark thing of like, it doesn't matter. In other words, you feel like the reason you're so devastated in life is because you got bill collectors coming to your house, you can't afford rent and all this sort of stuff. But the truth is that if I knew, if on the heels of the bill collector coming to my house, somebody had sent me an email saying, listen, your music is really great and you're going to get a check for $500,000,
right,
and you're going to, right. And, but they said, it's not going to happen till February. Then I would be like, bill collector, schmeal collector, you know, I wouldn't care, because the only thing that bothered me is I felt like that was a reflection of who I was, as the choices I had made were bad. And I was not talented.
Well, the expectations that we have kind of put upon us, you know?
Right, exactly. So kind of just, I decided that I better learn how to like my life now. If I can learn how to like my life now, where I'm applying for food stamps and stuff like that, then when it's going well, I'll really already know how to like my life. So I won't have this whole like, well, my life's going really well, but I still don't like it. I don't know what to fix about it. At this point, I can go, okay, I can learn how to like it now. And so I checked out a book called The Magic, I think. And it was about talking you through how to create a habit of gratitude. And so you start off with this whole thing. And so I follow the book. And the thing is that oddly enough, like by the end of the book, at the end of the month, I had like a relative sent me money and I had a bunch of students show up. So my attitude completely shifted the way things started to go for me. And it's continued to be something. I mean, obviously I have down moments here and there, and we've had, you know, dips where I'm like, okay, how are we going to pay rent type thing off and on, but there's still, it's been definitely from that moment. It's been going up.
It's been on the upslope. Well, but I mean, isn't that the case though? If you keep doing the work, if you keep, some people say, you know, if you keep shipping, you know, not just finishing something, but actually putting it out in the world and asking people to pay money for it and, you know, doing the thing, not being afraid of imperfection. You know, you talked about those early songs that they're not perfect, but they're going out there, you know?
Right.
And when you said that earlier in our conversation, it reminded me of I think it's the Cult of Done, that manifesto that goes around the internet every now and again. And one of the things that they say is perfection is the enemy of done, which I love, you know, because that ties right into my own sort of, hey kids, let's put on a show, punk rock attitude. You know, the sincerity behind something is more important than the polish, you know.
Right.
But isn't it the case that if you do that long enough, that when you do find yourself in those dips, you know from past experience that, you know what, this is a really lousy week, and you know, I'm going to speak for myself. I'm having, that's not necessarily this week, but I've had these weeks where it's like, okay, well, this week, you know, lunch is going to be a protein drink, and you know, and dinner might not be dinner, and we'll just kind of get through. And this is going to be late, and that's going to be late, and this is going to get paid when it gets paid.
Yeah,
because you know that something is going to come along because you've been. And this isn't even a metaphysical or a woo-woo kind of thing. You've been putting things out there, and one of those things is going to bite. You had your student's parent recommend you to other people? And doesn't that come just out of the blue sometimes? It's like, oh, it's a tight month. And then you get a recommendation email from somebody, you know, it's like, oh, people, maybe you haven't even, this happens to me. You haven't worked with these folks in years. And all of a sudden they're sending you an email with, hey, I'd like you to meet so-and-so. He does this and he needs that. And can you help him? And there you are, all set for the next 2 months. You know, I don't know. Maybe that's the lesson, right? Is just keep doing the work and staying true to the thing that that you do. Because again, only you can do it the way you do it. And the people who appreciate what you do are out there. And little by little by little, they are telling more folks about you, and it's getting out there. And incrementally, those valleys come more and more infrequently. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I remember when I worked at, I used to wait tables at Macaroni Grill, and I had this this weird thought one time when I was standing there. They had opened, okay, we're open the doors for lunch, and I stood there and I had this weird thought where I'm like, what if nobody shows up? What if nobody shows up ever? Like, what if for some, because anytime anybody can go out to eat, right? There's like so many choices, right? You could go to the grocery store, you can go get takeout. Right. Why would they happen to choose, of all the choices, Romano's Macaroni Grill? Like, why? Like, it seems so bizarre. Because every time somebody makes a choice to do it, it seems to that person completely random. Well, where do you want to go? And the Chili's? No, you know, let's go to Romano's. Yeah, that sounds good. And that's when they go. And that's when I've kind of applied that to getting, you know, my licensing income and getting my sales. Because why is it that every single month I make roughly around the same amount of money, ever increasing, in Spotify listens or in sales? Like, there's this line of people that's standing there and they're like, okay, now it's your shift. You go in there and buy all her music. It doesn't make any sense. But what happens is you just, like you're saying, you just put it out there enough. And I have gotten, so I can kind of expect, oh, I make a couple hundred from this, make a couple, you know, hundred from that, I make 1,000 from this, whatever. And you start to expect it. But really, when you look at it, every single person who's bought it, it's like a random decision. So it's, to me, it's like a funny thing to sort of, you just have to get on board with the fact that, listen, you're not doing something like working in a factory where you're creating something that you just put out there. You just have to expect that there will be enough random occurrences to people to decide to like your music or to put it in a movie or whatever it is, that it's going to sustain you. And I think that that's exactly what you're saying, is you just, and when you get to expecting that, it feels a lot more settled. It feels a lot less like, oh, I'm trying to make it. I'm trying to make it. And you get like, I made it. This is what people who made it do. This is, you know what I mean? Right. Like you look at every actor at one point there, and we've seen this happen with actors. They make a wrong choice and they're out of gigs. Nobody's going to hire them anymore. But up to that point, there was a feeling of like, oh, we'll randomly pick so-and-so, you know?
The guy who used to play Lex Luthor on Smallville, I think his name is Michael Rosenbaum. I just heard him. He's got like everybody now, he's got a podcast. He, you know, he's one of these guys who had a little peak of success to us. It appeared that way. And then kind of dropped off the radar. But we don't realize, and this speaks to what you're talking about of like, you know, teaching and licensing and Spotify and all these different streams. One might dip away, but the others are there. And like you say, it becomes kind of consistent, even if one falls out a little bit. It's replaced or supplemented by another one rising up. You know, this guy might not have had a TV series for 5 years, but he's been directing, he's been doing plays, he's whatever.
Right.
Again, the combination of doing the work and making sure that that work is, while it all serves your passion, it's, you know, I mean, it's the cliche of not putting all your eggs in one basket, right? It's having those different streams. And finding ways to cultivate that. I have kept you for a really long time. We're coming up on an hour and a half. So, and thank you, because I know that you've dug into your music time to do this conversation. But I think people are going to get a lot out of it. And so kind of in that spirit, you know, I'm not asking you to get up on the soapbox or whatever, unless you want to, but The audience at this point is small for this podcast, but the people who do respond are people who tend to, they're struggling. They're at an early stage, most of them, in their creative journey. And and some of them are suffering from depression, mental illness. Some of them are suffering from physical illness. Some of them, you know, like you and I have been, are just poor. and trying to find that space, you know, that balance between, well, you know, I got to pay the bills, but I can't not create. So knowing who's probably listening to this, what would you, this is your time to give that big burst of wisdom. Take what you've learned and encapsulate it down and shoot it down the airwaves. No pressure at all.
Okay. So first of all, I'm going to say it's going to be okay. I really do believe that, you know, the whole thing of like within every acorn is the potential for an oak tree. The acorn is meant to be an oak tree. And if you want to create, if this is something that drives you, then it's not that you're like, in a way, I remember listening to some guy, Mike Dooley, he's a speaker, writer, love him. And he says, don't ask if life is fair. He's like, the universe is stacked in your favor. And sometimes, a lot of times it feels like that's not, the cards are stacked in your favor. If you're meant to create, then that is where you will blossom. So don't worry about whether, you know, should I do this? If you want to do it, then that means that that's what you're meant to do. So don't worry about that. And then the other thing is the whole thing of not quitting, because man, there have been so many times where I've been like, at this point, I should just quit. And in fact, I had talked to one coach, mentor. And it was like about like figuring out your ideal work or whatever, and a career coach. And she was like, well, don't say that you didn't make it in music. This was about 5-6 years ago. She's like, just go, okay, I had a good music career. Now I'm ready to move on to my next job, you know, and whatever it may be type thing. And I felt all this like rebellion of like, this, I can never leave this. This is the thing is like you've talked about, you keep doing it. This is the reason why people quit music, you know, is because you get criticism, you're afraid of rejection, it's hard to make money a lot of times. And, but the thing is that when that happens to you, know, this is why people quit. And if you don't, then that moves you on to the next level. You get past that hurdle. And then that's when you start to get I just had somebody who emailed me today who's asking me for permission to use my song. She lives in Michigan and she's doing a trapeze show. And she wants to use song to do a trapeze show. Yeah. And I'm like, this is the thing. This is why I did music. Yes, I want the, you know, $20,000 licensing deal to show up at some point. But this is really, I mean, how amazing. A whole crowd of people in Michigan are getting to watch a trapeze artist and listen to my song at the same time. And that's what, I mean, and that's the thing is I really feel like if this is something that you love doing, if it's something that you want to do, then you are meant to succeed at it. This is what you're meant to do in the same way that, you know, a lemon seed is meant to become a tree, a lemon tree specifically. So don't worry if you're trying to create, you know, lemon trees and you're like, oh, what is wrong with me? I should stop. I should just be whatever, you know. Grass. You're never going to be that. You'll never be good at it. And you'll just be so, you know, that's what I feel like. I know it sounds hard. And sometimes it's hard to just, you know, don't quit because it may not go exactly the way you want to go. We know that, but it will never get to where you want to be. If you quit, you'll never get there.
Fantastic. That's great. I appreciate that you, you know, again, dug into your time, your music time, your guarded time to have this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me on your show and ask me all these questions and give me a chance to share my story.
Thanks. Now go make some music.
Oh, I will, for sure. Good night.
Good night. Well, there you have it, beloved listeners, my conversation with Emma Wallace. I am emma.com, Spotify, Pandora, iTunes, Amazon, Tidal, anywhere you can buy or stream music, you can find Emma Wallace's dozen albums, singles, and EPs, including her very latest release out August 31st, 2018, Immortal. So if you're listening to this before August 31st, it's almost here. If you're listening to this on August 31st, you should listen, you should stream, you should buy Immortal from Emma Wallace. And if it's after August 31st, you should, you know, do all that stuff that I just said. She's an independent creator, just like so many of you. And so you can support her work by listening to and buying her music. If you have any questions, comments, direct questions or comments you might have for Emma, you can leave a comment in the show notes for episode 10 of Sonatotum at mattselznick.com. You can just click on podcasts there and you will find episode 10. Or you can just go directly to sonatotum.com. Check out episode 10, the show notes, the comments are right at the bottom. You can leave a comment for myself or Emma. You can also email me at mwsmedia@gmail.com. Comment on this episode and other episodes of Sonatotum. If you are my patron, you are listening to the unedited and uncut edition of my conversation with Emma Wallace. Almost an hour and a half of conversation, unedited and uncut, start to finish. You can become a patron at patreon.com/mattselznick. And by the way, you can also become Emma's patron at patreon.com/IamEmmaMusic. And when you become her patron, you're going to get her new EP before the rest of the world. It comes out for the rest of the world on August 31st. If you become Emma Wallace's patron, then you'll get it even faster. Enjoy this episode? It would be so, so cool if you would tell as many people as you think would dig it all about Sonatotum and send them to sonatotum.com or grab their phone and look at their podcast app and just subscribe to Sonatotum in their podcast app, and then do that on your own phone too, right? You want to subscribe to the show. The more folks who subscribe to Sonatotum, the larger the audience, the more engaged and active the conversation between you and me and everyone else trying to make stuff, find success, and stay healthy and sane while we do it. So please share Sonatotum with your friends, rate and review Sonatotum in iTunes or anywhere you get your podcasts, and subscribe. I really enjoyed conversation with Emma Wallace. I thank her for being the inaugural interview guest. If you are a creative person and you think you might have something helpful to say, a good story to share about your creative journey, you'd like to share that with the Sonatotum audience, you can contact me at mwsmedia@gmail.com or just use the contact page on mattselznick.com and let's talk about you being a guest on Sonatotum. My name is Matthew Wayne Selznick. Take care.